Accession number 13917, Mrs. A.V. Mason, reel 2.
Mrs. Mason, reel 2. How long did you have to stay in England after you'd been evacuated for the Suez affair?
We stayed in England 3 months. October, November, came back, well, it was mid-September to mid-December, and we came back in time for Christmas. And that was very curious, because it was actually very early days to come back. I mean, the sores of Suez were still around. The Arab friends we had, we'd bump into in the streets of Amman, and they wouldn't look at us. They wouldn't have anything to do with us. We laid very low. We just saw ourselves and a few foreigners who were back. The little school reopened, so the school children went back to school. Months afterwards, these Arab friends told us, "We were so sorry we couldn't welcome you back, Mrs. Mason, but at that time you must realize we couldn't have anything to do with foreigners," and we said we totally understood at the time and we understand now. But it was a very curious atmosphere. People looked at us rather askance, sort of, what are we doing there? But you live through it. With understanding, you have to empathise with these people.
Did this extend up to the highest levels of the Jordanian government?
I would think so. I would think so. I think they were very standoffish and very correct. It was a ghastly episode, the whole Suez episode. My husband didn't say very much, I must admit, about how his relationships with members of the government and members out of the government were. But I'm sure he would have said that they were very circumspect, not easy. And before, they had been very easy.
So it was a sort of icy politeness.
Very icy politeness. And this went by the summer. It was completely gone, and they talked about their cold shoulders with regret, and all we could do, as I said before, was to excuse them, forgive them. Really.
Selwyn Lloyd was inclined to maintain in the spring of 1957, but in fact the people in the Arab world respected the United Kingdom more because it had decided to use force at Suez. Do you think that was self-deception on his part?
I think there's the Arab world and the Arab world. I don't know whether that was true of all. I mean, there's no such thing as all Arabs because they're all so different. I think among a certain group of Arabs that probably was very true. But I don't think it ran right through the Arab world. It's very easy to talk, actually, with the benefit of hindsight. That's the best I can do.
Were you aware at this time of a threat from Egypt of subversion using the voice of the Arabs?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. You heard the voice of the Arabs if you were walking through the town. And it wasn't even subversion. It was open version. Arab mobs could be created from peaceful market people very quickly and very easily. The other thing, of course, is that there were so many people who were totally unemployed and idle in the refugee camps. A lot of men, a lot of young youths who had nothing to do. And so when somebody offered them the chance to go out and throw some stones and to make a riot, this was great. And so the fact that there were at least two, if not three, refugee camps very near the centre of Amman was very dangerous, really, because there was potential manpower for riots and unrest right there. When there was nothing going on, they sort of sat on street corners and listened to the voice of the Arabs. Oh, yes, it was very, very real.
What sort of targets did they attack when they were got up into a mob?
Depending on their mood, like as not, it was against all foreigners. Like it or not, it was against British. But then it was very hard for an ordinary Arab boy to differentiate between a British and, let us say, a German riding along in a car. You knew, because of your license plates, that you were foreign. Sometimes it was against the king. You never knew. It was a
Did you have warning that this was likely to happen?
Well, the warning that I always picked up was when I was in town shopping. You picked up an atmosphere, first of all. Looks, what people said. You could feel tension. You knew something was going to happen. And after the first one or two riots, you got to be very acute. Your barometer was very finely tuned. And you knew that something wasn't quite right. In fact, once or twice, I remember telling my husband, I was in Amman this morning, and I don't feel things are right. Something is happening. And he'd say, well, so such and such is about to happen, or I'll take note of that, and something might have happened. But you do pick up. All I can say is it's an air and atmosphere.
What I meant was, did you ever get official warnings from the Jordanian authorities?
Never from the Jordanian authorities, no. Our own embassy would say, you know, stay in, or our own embassy knew very much, usually knew what was going to happen. I think very rarely were they caught. Sometimes they didn't know how serious it would be. I mean, there were times when my husband couldn't get home, and they were not very pleasant, because there we were stuck in our house on the hill next to the Royal Palace. He couldn't get home because there were too many rioters in the streets.
Well, they'd be around the palace, would they? Or around the
hill? Not around the palace, because the palace was up on a hill, but in the streets leading to the gate to the palace, and all over the town. I mean, these are the days before the bypasses. You had to go through the middle of town to get anywhere else. And I think that, I think that's all there.
How did the Jordanian authorities deal with these riots when they occurred?
How did they deal with the riots when they occurred? If anybody dealt with them, it was the army, and usually the Bedouin, because the Bedouin were called in from the deserts round, or the Arab Legion, to protect the king. And they were fiercely loyal to the king. And if any of these riots were anti-monarchist, the Bedouin would come in with their armor and surround the palace or take up position in the streets. I think that the king and the Jordanian government played a very careful game, because you have to let the crowd let off steam to some extent. You can't sit on steam. Yes, windows were smashed. Yes, cars were overturned. Yes, things were set afire. But I think they knew how far they could let it go without calling on the army. It wasn't the police. The police were not terribly effective. It was the army, and usually the Bedouin.
Why was it the police weren't effective? Because most countries, it's a riot squad of the police that deals with a stone throw.
I can't answer that. Only conjecture, unless the police were made up of Palestinians themselves, unless their own allegiances were questionable. I can't answer that.
Egypt was certainly very active as a source of threat and trying to influence the behaviour of its neighbours. What about Syria? Did you conceive of Syria as being a source of threat or disruption?
Well, Syria was always threat or disruption. I think the answer is, at that time, no, but I'm hesitant. I won't give it. I don't think that we could see where the threat from Syria, or at least I couldn't see where the threat from Syria would have come. Syria was a bit volatile itself.
Certainly very unstable at that time.
At that time, it was very unstable. But I think I'm right in saying that Syria didn't pose a great threat to Jordan then.
But was Israel conceived of as being an immediate threat?
I would think the answer to that is no. There are always border incidents. One reason, for example, that Heath and I never crossed through the Mandelbaum Gate into Israel was that Heath always felt that if we'd done so and there had been a border incident that night, the powers that be would have said, oh, you know, Mason has just made a trip to Israel. What did he do when he was there? So we never did cross into Israel from Jordan. There were incidents all the time, both ways across the border. But I think that the vision of Israel breaking out of its boundaries then had not been thought of.
In the spring of 1957, there was supposed to have been an attempted coup d'etat by certain military units at Sirka, led by their officers. Did you hear anything about that?
I wish I could throw more light on that for you, but spring of 57, I think there were more riots. I really, and I'm rather ashamed, I can't throw very much light on that.
This was the occasion when the king was supposed to have gone down to the camp at Sirka personally.
I remember that. I remember him going down to the camp. He was extremely brave. But I can't give you any more leads onto that at all. But I remember the incident when he did go to Sirka. And it wasn't the first time when the king had gone personally to address his troops. He was a very brave man. And he was really... in his own funny way, a charismatic leader of his own people. But I can't help you with the 57 episode.
Around about that time, because of the Suez affair and its repercussions, there was a shift in Jordan, and British assistance was fading out, being replaced, at least on the financial side, by American assistance. Do you remember hearing anything about that?
Oh, yes, one heard a great deal about it also. Again, I can't add anything to that. One heard a great deal about it. The Americans were much more interested in, and I think perhaps realized the strategic importance of Jordan. I can't throw any new light there, except repeating the obvious things. I think the king would have preferred to have continued with Great Britain, but the scenario changed. That really is all I can say.
Do you remember the American declaration of the Eisenhower Doctrine in the spring of 1958?
Now, can you refresh me on that?
It was rather like the Truman Doctrine updated. The idea was that if any Arab country was being threatened by a communist country or a country controlled by international communism, the United States would give assistance to it to maintain its independence and sovereignty.
I remember it, but again, I can't add anything to that from my own point of view.
You don't recall it having any particular impact on...
No, I don't. I don't recall it having any great impact on life in Amman at that time.
The next major development really came in February of 1958 with the creation of the United Arab Republic. Do you remember that?
I do.
And what repercussions did that have?
I'm trying to think of politically what repercussions it had. It didn't affect our life living in Amman, my life living in Amman. You see, being the wife of a diplomat, I wasn't privy to what went on. I did hear things. But my husband and I never went to sleep talking about the political events of the day. Yes, one knew in broad sweeps what went on. But I do remember that. And I remember thinking it was highly significant. But I really can't add anything to your archives for that.
I think perhaps you might have sensed a change in the atmosphere, since you seem to have been very finely tuned and sensitive to what was going on around you when you went into the markets. Do you remember any sort of sense of expectancy or anything?
No, I don't. I don't. I don't notice it. I mean, the Arabs were either friendly or not friendly, really. There were not very many degrees of in-betweens. But I remember life at that stage was fairly stable for me. But as I say, the political innuendos I don't know very much about.
So at that same time, in that spring, there was a great deal of tension and disorder in Lebanon, and the formation of the UAR seemed to add to that.
Yes.
Created a situation in which the Lebanese government was demanding, virtually demanding American or British military assistance. President Shamoun was absolutely intent on involving Western powers. Did you hear anything at all about that?
Oh yes, we heard a great deal about it. We're very concerned about it. And very, very concerned with, you know, vis-à-vis our own position. Mm. And if troops went into the Lebanon, what would the Jordanians think of us? And what would the other Arab countries around and about also think? Yes, one heard a great deal about it. But from my point of view, again, it didn't disrupt ordinary life in town. I mean, we kept on living and kept on seeing our friends, Arab and foreign and what have you. I'm sorry to be so vague, but if one can carry on living with children, feeling relatively safe, which I did at that period, although all these things were going on, I felt okay, and so that for example, the Eisenhower Doctrine didn't have a profound effect on me, although I remember it at the time. And the troops going into the Lebanon, I remember it at the time. But it didn't have a profound effect on life as we lived it in Jordan.
Do you remember what people did think was going to happen if there was an intervention in the Lebanon? Because it was off and on for some months. There were various plans to send an Anglo-American force into Lebanon, eventually just a purely American one.
That's right, that's right. I think mostly among the foreigners they were saying, you know, all this is, there might be a great eruption in Jordan. But I mean, this was a very serious move, and as I remember, the crowds didn't come out at that time in the streets. There were no riots. There were no great upset. Life went on, and of course the rioters were there. They could have been called on very easily.
It's quite significant, isn't it? At the time there was a fairly massive movement of troops into Lebanon, about 20,000 in the end.
Yeah.
There was no serious response.
I think the Americans had perhaps a very dicey time. Now wait a minute. I think perhaps the American community was sent out at that time.
This would have been in July 1958 when they finally went in.
Possibly.
After a lot of...
Possibly, but we stayed.
Now, the reaction, the Jordanian reaction to the formation of the United Arab Republic was to seek a closer union with other Arab countries, and they tried to interest the Saudi Arabians in forming some sort of anti-radical bloc, and the Saudis wouldn't play because they had certain disputes with the Jordanians.
Yes.
But the Iraqis did, and the Arab Union was formed.
That's right.
Do you remember that happening?
I remember that much more clearly, because it seemed to us sitting on the sideline, and me sitting on the sidelines, that here were the two young Hashemite kingdoms, that there was an affinity between the two countries with a long common border to start with, and that this made a great deal of sense. The Iraqis and the Jordanians, they never lost much love over each other, although they came from a common tribal stock way back. But it did seem to make sense. And I think, I remember that very clearly. I think that we were very optimistic that this might be a way forward to stability, a sort of peaceful way forward. We were very optimistic.
Had you actually visited Iraq at all?
I'm trying to think when we visited Iraq. We had a wonderful trip. We drove by car from Amman following the H4 pipeline to Baghdad.
This has been the inspection road, was it actually alongside the
pipeline? It's alongside the pipeline. And you stay overnight. There's sort of guest houses where you stay and you paid a few pounds and off you go again. And we stayed in Baghdad a few days. And then we went up north to Iraqi Kurdistan to stay with a member of the Barjani family. There was a young Barjani in the Iraqi embassy in Amman whom we knew very well, and he said, you must stay with my uncle or whatever. And we stayed in a place called Arbil, having passed through Sulaymaniyya and Halabja. It was an absolutely breathtaking trip, wonderful, to be stay as guests with of a Kurdish family who were enormously hospitable. The Kurds were very strong, virile, attractive people. It was a wonderful trip back to Baghdad, and then back along the pipeline. And we read aloud to each other, depending on who was driving, Seven Pillars of Wisdom on this trip. So it's a very memorable one. And I'm trying to think when that must have been in spring.
Spring of 1958.
58. We were gone, I think, about 10 days on this trip. It took 2 days to drive to Baghdad and 2 days to drive back.
Did you go anywhere near Habaniya on the way?
Yes, we did. We stopped at all these places. We visited the markets and the souks and just delighted in them, really. It was a wonderful eye-opener. And we, very visibly, the Kurds were very different from the so-called Iraqis.
In what ways?
Well, they looked different. They dressed different. They behaved different. They were more energetic. They were more of a virile people.
Did you sense any sort of atmosphere in Baghdad? What did you make of Baghdad compared to Amman?
Baghdad, I'll tell you what really struck in my mind, about Baghdad. Enormous marble palaces lived in by rich people, but propped against the wall of the marble palace were reed huts and hovels. Now, you looked at these and you'd say, how perfectly awful, and somebody would say, but they're the marsh Arabs who've come up for the summer months, and they're relatives of the people who live in the big house. Don't worry about them. Still, I have this great vision in my mind of the ghastly contrast between totally, indigent people and, crass wealth living cheek by jowl with each other. Baghdad was very busy. The climate wasn't nearly as pleasant. It was very hot, very sticky. Amman is hot, but it's a dry heat. It's a more of a desert heat. And Baghdad was less pleasant, bigger, more active. In a way, I felt that Baghdad was perhaps more important. There was a bigger embassy. There were more people.
Did you think that the Iraqis and the Jordanians would be compatible within our...
Yes, I did, because there were great similarities between them. Yes, I thought that they would be compatible. This is me, as just a sort of a neutral observer. Yeah. They looked the same, their lifestyle was the same, except for the extremely... You did see the marsh Arabs. Jordan doesn't have marsh Arabs. Their souks were the same, with local differences. They still smoked humble bubble and played backgammon. I felt very much at home there, because I was just what I'd come from, except on a bigger scale.
Did the coup d'etat on the 14th of July come as a complete surprise to you?
Well, it did to me personally, and I don't know. I know we talked about this, and I know that there had been a warning to the embassy in Baghdad, and I don't know whether the warning had been ignored or what. We had had Nuri Pasha for dinner about a week before this coup d'etat. Pleasant evening, normal evening. The first we heard of it, I think, was the morning of the 17th of, was it June or July? July.
July, yes.
That Nuri Pasha had been murdered, and I can't remember the sequence. Was it the king first and Nuri next, or Nuri first and the king next? It was a terrible moment because of this, of the sort of alignment between Jordan and Iraq, and because King Hussein and King Faisal were cousins, and I think were not close, but they were the same ilk, shall we say. And then immediately, I think the first thing that went through our minds was, what about us? What about our king here? And these things were very uncertain, very tense. And I know that there was huge diplomatic activity because my husband was back and forth and in and out, and I hardly ever saw him. But my husband told me, I know the king felt very insecure himself. He went to see the king by request. Whether it was the 18th, the 19th, I can't remember, I don't know. And the king had a piece of paper in his hand. And he was going to read from the piece of paper. And Heath said, "Your Majesty, I have something extremely important. May I tell you this now?" And this was the plan to send the paratroops to the RAF Zirka, at which the king put his piece of paper away and never read from it. Now, Heath often thought that the king thought his situation was so desperate and so vulnerable that he was going to resign or abdicate. Who knows? I don't know. But he felt that when he heard that the troops were coming, he felt, well, I've got backup. I'm not going to. He felt this in his veins. He was there. He saw the king. He saw his face. He felt the atmosphere. And I feel that he may have been right, but we will never know. We'll never be able to follow that up.
Your husband was in charge at that time.
He was in charge. Charles Johnson was on leave. So he was in charge all through this crisis. Charles Johnson came back very quickly with the RAF. Because he wasn't going to miss this show, quite rightly. But it was an enormous responsibility, wonderful for my husband. And it was really due to his diplomatic initiative that the RAF, that the paratroopers did come.
Now, King Hussein says in his memoirs that he actually had warning of the coup d'etat by Brigadier Qasim and Colonel Arif, and that he tried to warn Nuri.
That's interesting.
2 days before, and that
Nuri
laughed it off and wouldn't take him seriously. Yeah. Did you hear anything about
no,
that?
No, I didn't. No, I haven't. I never heard that. I don't know how generally that was going around at the time. But I knew that there had been the rumours of warnings after the event were quite right, because I think the British Embassy had warning that something. Oh, that was the same time the British Embassy was sacked, after all.
In Baghdad.
In Baghdad. You know, it was an extremely unpleasant time. And in fact, the British ADC lost his life. There was a British officer who was killed that time. And then a lot of talk about it. Yes, that they had been tipped off, but didn't believe it. Who had tipped whom off? And that I don't know. But certainly there was a belief around that there had been underground murmurings, which perhaps had not been attended to sufficiently.
The king, in his memoirs, the king says that when he suggested the Iraqi army might be disaffected, Nuri said to him, or one of the other senior Iraqis in the delegation, "You should be more worried about your own army,"
yeah,
which in the past has been unreliable.
Yeah. I think that's probably a fair comment. It's not a thing that Nuri Pasha would have said. Nuri Pasha was a wonderful man. An old man, very senior diplomat, very highly respected, charming man. I remember when he came to dinner, we talked a great deal about T.E. Lawrence, because we just read this book we talked about, because I know that Nuri Pasha had spent his youth riding on camels up and down. He was one of these scouts. And he turned to us at one stage, to me or to Heath, and said, Lawrence? Oh, yes, he was one of the scouts. In other words, he was just one of the boys. He wasn't the great man that you were led to believe he was when you read his books.
Writing your memoirs does have a way of enhancing your
reputation. It does indeed. It does indeed, yes.
Did you see a lot of Newry, or was he here
near? No, we didn't see a lot of him. He came to our house once, and I'd never met him before, but found him a very charming, very easy guest to have. And quite honestly, I can't remember who else we had. We probably had the American ambassador and some Arabs. I can't remember who it was. An easy, pleasant man to entertain. He heard our dilemma of having Tengku Abdurrahman in our sitting room, having a lonely omelette. And he was charming. He said, I'd like to say hello to him. So he went with my husband and just sat down for 10 minutes with him and chatted. We didn't bring either of them out to the big party because it wouldn't have been fair on either of them. But he was that sort of man. Because we knew he was interested in history, the other thing he was interested in, yes, was cricket. And I remember my husband read up on the cricket scores that day, so he could discuss cricket with Nuri Pasha when he came for dinner. And in fact, he did talk about cricket, and he was quite delighted that somebody knew what the score was. I don't know who was playing who. He was relaxed,